This is Shambhala-san, editor of web publications Rod Mead Sperry, and you're listening to Shambhala-san Audio. Eco-philosopher, author, and professor Stephanie Kaza joins me today to talk about the concept of green dharma, which is the title of her new Shambhala-san double review of two books, Daniel Goleman's Ecological Intelligence and A Buddhist Response to the Climate Emergency, edited by John Stanley, David R. Loy, and Gyurme Dorje. Here Kaza sheds light on both books, the shape her own work is taking, a possible new cause celeb for people sympathetic to Buddhism's aims, and more. Stephanie, your review of Ecological Intelligence and A Buddhist Response to the Climate Emergency begins by stating that each book has a hopeful view, that we can create positive results for the environment. How does this hopeful view differ between the two books?
Well, that's a great question. The first book, Daniel Goleman's book, is his hope is based on transparency, a sense that if we just know what we're going to buy, what's in it, and so on, that we'll make good choices. So knowledge is power. And that's his sort of version of hope. And in the second book, knowledge is power, but even more than that, bringing out the Buddhist point of view in global climate change, the author suggests that prayer, aspirational prayer, also is powerful. So this is quite a distinct difference. The first book is based on data and knowledge and number crunching and real straight facts about products. But the climate book takes Buddhists particularly to really apply aspirational prayer in a directed and thoughtful way towards an environmental problem. And we haven't seen that kind of call before in the Buddhist environmental thought conversation.
And so in either case, would you say that the hopeful view being presented is a realistic one?
Oh, that's pretty tough to know, isn't it? Now, sometimes we hope it will all turn out well, but there's, as we well know from a Buddhist perspective, there are endless impinging factors that affect how things all turn out. So I tend to take a pragmatic view personally. You must always stay positive in your actions so that they achieve the best results. But whether we really solve these climate problems effectively, I have big questions. And the same with our purchasing power. We have an awful lot to learn, and there's a lot of other mitigating factors. So I think the jury's out in both cases. We just won't know for quite a while.
Sure. Now, you suggest that one thing that is overlooked by the Goleman book is the problem of tracking corporate infractions against the environment. Is there a way to do this that you would propose?
It's mostly just a kind of record-keeping thing that's just difficult to work out mechanically. If you, for example, if you think of all the healthcare fraud in the system today, and that's an easier one for people to relate to, where you're overcharged or mischarged or somebody's making a lot of extra profit on a medication, many things that go undetected. Then multiply that in terms of in product or production. And once you get outside the United States, we just don't have legal oversight to double-check things. It would require a tremendous amping up of something like the Environmental Protection Agency and customs inspections and agricultural inspections. We would really have to look into all the shipping containers that come into this country, and we just don't have enough personnel to do that right now. So it would require a tremendous commitment at some bureaucratic, you know, federal, state, international levels to actually pull this off. We probably are better off with peer pressure and whistleblowing and exposing those corporate giants who are really egregious, and then hoping that they'll set the standard for being for misbehaving, and then at the same time we can pull out those who are really showing off best practices, and they then might set the standard for good behavior. So that seems to be more the approach that people are doing now, just because of lack of personnel to convict or convince or track what's happening.
Hmm. You talk in the review of melting at the so-called third pole, the Himalayan glaciers, saying that we don't know enough about it and that the Buddhists might consider making it a cause celeb. Why?
Well, this occurred to me that we could take it up because this is a birthplace of a great cultural mecca for Buddhists, where the headwaters of many of the world's important rivers are that flow through countries that have been influenced by Buddhism. the third pole, the Himalayan glacier area, is overlooked by many, many people. We tend to think of the North Pole and the South Pole. Those get all the news coverage. But this so-called, I kind of like that third pole. I'm not sure how common the usage is, but it's difficult to get to. The research has been somewhat limited, particularly on the Indian side. The Chinese are doing more research, but in terms of that getting into the public coverage and conversation, it's not at all common. Now, Buddhists are not known for their environmental activism generally, particularly American Buddhists who have taken up Buddhism more for personal reasons. So this would be the sphere of socially engaged Buddhists who want to make activism part of their Buddhist practice, and particularly for those for whom environmental concerns are paramount. Climate is on everybody's list right now. It's as the top concern because it affects every single other environmental concern. So to direct some attention just at the educational and awareness level to the Himalayan glaciers could be very helpful. And just in the same way as we help to bring world attention to the plight of Tibetan refugees and the treatment by the Chinese and the policies, we could also direct attention towards the environment of the Tibetan plateau and the downstream effects of what's happening there, because that affects Buddhists in China, Buddhists in Vietnam and in Laos, the whole South Asian peninsula. It's quite extensive. It's the most, when you add up all the major watersheds that flow out of the Himalayan glaciers, it's probably, I'm sure, it's more miles and more acre feet of water than any other water system in the world.
Wow. Now, you also mentioned Buddhist initiatives to address climate change, like solar-powered temples in Japan. Is this sort of renewal not happening in the States solely because of the costs involved, or are there other factors?
That's a good question. It seems like in terms of environmental initiatives for United States centers, they've been focused more on land protection and stewardship and great care for food and eating practices. But as far as energy practices, many centers are at the mercy of their local municipal utilities. So if the utility has a green portfolio, there, that's great. But if they must take the energy as it comes to them, that's where they start. So the incentives vary tremendously from city and state and region, from one to another, and it may just not be as feasible for a number of the United States centers to take this up. So the examples I've heard about internationally, I'm not sure what the supportive conditions are, whether it's just strong leadership, the priest just says, we are going to do this, and they're very creative about it, or there are literally regulatory incentives that help make it more possible. I've actually heard more about Christian churches putting solar panels on their roofs than I have about some of the Buddhist temples. But maybe I'm missing some of the most current information, and it's happening as we speak.
Well, I'm wondering if you can suggest any ways that you know of that people in meditative communities who are listening right now might make an ecologically sound difference in how their centers are run.
Well, I take quite a bit of inspiration and hope from the green faith or the greening of religion movement, which has is more visible in the United States in the Christian and Jewish communities. And they have taken on some of the most basic things are composting and waste management, recycling in their centers, getting their parishioners to really take care of their waste products and not, having coffee mugs instead of coffee cups. And then also some of the land stewardship issues. People can engage with their local neighbors and land trusts and try to have their, if they have a rural center or a center with land, be part of the land conservation community. Very often religious groups hold prime pieces of land, and if they work with state agencies or private land trusts, it can benefit the local plants and animals, so that's it's one larger protected area. As far as energy initiatives go, I think, again, we could learn from some of the Christian initiatives and try and find out in the different neighborhoods and the different regions of the country where we can move this agenda forward. And then the trick is to really promote these best practices and share them among each other. So I've long had a fantasy that there would be a Buddhist environmental nonprofit here in the United States, but to date, the only one I've heard of it was formed around animal rights, and that has since moved to Europe. So if we had a way to share our bright ideas, that could help really inspire each other.
Well, that is true. Stephanie, what I hope is that some folks reading and listening to this now will share their bright ideas. We've been having a lot of discussion on Shambhala Sunspace about these issues, but I'm particularly thrilled to have you weighing in here now. Thank you so much. I would be remiss if I didn't ask, what are you working on?
I'm hoping to start work on a new book on Buddhist attitudes towards food.
Really?
And food is very, very much in the news today. I'm working with a lot of graduate students on initiatives in local food, food distribution systems, agriculture, sustainable agriculture as a way to protect our agricultural lands. So it seems that along with climate is a great interest in how we take care of our food products and our farmers. Maybe this is particularly true here in Vermont and in New England, but when people are feeling so helpless about the big scale issues like climate, if they can take care of what's on their dinner plate, it seems to make them feel more positive and virtuous and more a part of their local community. So I have to look into this to see whether Buddhists have something new to add to the conversation, but I think they do. There's long been a tradition of mindfulness practice around food in Buddhist circles, and whether that's in the kitchen or for the eater, and what we could add into this book might be something about with the grower, and how do we bring mindfulness to the whole system of food production and distribution and consumption.
That sounds fantastic. Thank you, Stephanie. Really appreciate it.
Well, you're very welcome, and I'm glad you're adding this as a service to your readers. It really enhances the community and the conversation to use the web this way. I think it's terrific.
Thank you so much. We're glad to have you there. That was eco-philosopher, author, and professor Stephanie Kaza, who wrote Green Dharma, the lead book review in our current issue. My thanks to her for joining us. You'll find Kaza's review on page 83 of the September 2009 issue. This is Rod Mead Sperry. Thanks for listening to Shambhala Sun Audio.